Today's Teisho will be on case 12 of the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 12 is entitled, Zuigan Calls His Master. Zuigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, Master. And then he answered, Yes, sir. Then he would say, Be wide awake. And he would answer, Yes, sir. Henceforth, never be deceived by others. No, I won't. Mumon's comment, Old Zuigan buys and sells himself. He takes out a lot of god masks and devil masks and puts them on and plays with them. For what, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake and the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. If you imitate Zuigan, you will play the fox. Mumon's verse, clinging to the deluded way of consciousness, students of the Dharma do not realize truth. The seed of birth and death through endless eons, the fool calls it the true original self. I'd like to thank everybody for coming here this morning and practicing Zen. It's wonderful to sit with you. Many of us have been practicing together for years. We sit together all week, and then every other Saturday we come here and we sit together for half a day. And it's my idea of paradise. Just wonderful. And it's wonderful to be practicing with everybody who's here today. Maybe you've had a difficult week. Maybe you've had a challenging week. Maybe you're tired. Maybe you have a lot of cares or a lot of stress. People sometimes get into Zazen, into Zen meditation, because they have a lot on their shoulders. You can find real peace if you do a lot of meditation, if you do a lot of Zen meditation. I don't think I could have gotten through graduate school without meditation. In fact, I know I couldn't have, and I don't think I could have survived in my job without meditation. You know, when I first came here to Rutgers, I had a meeting with my boss, who was the chairman of the English department, and his name was Thomas Van Lan, and he was famous for being a mean old man. He was like a troll in a children's story. He was this gnarly old man. He actually, his specialty was Norwegian literature, so the troll comparison makes a lot of sense, you know. And he had many problems himself, you know, many personal problems, but he hadn't responded to them well, and he became famous for being very gruff and sarcastic. And these were still the days where people could smoke in public. So he'd be down there in his office chain-smoking cigarettes. And so I got called to see the chairman, and I had just gotten here to Rutgers. And the chairman, Tom, was sitting in his office smoking cigarettes, and he sat me down and he said, listen, if you want to get tenure at Rutgers, here's what you have to do. and he laid it out. You have to have this many articles. You have to have a book. It has to be published by a good press, and these would be bad presses, and this would be a good press. You have to give this many talks. And he basically said, if you don't do this, you're out of here. And I looked at this list, and it was so long, right? I thought, oh my God, I'll never be able to do this, you know, because I had hardly any of the things I needed. Some people come to a job with some of those items already accomplished, but I had none of them accomplished. And it was so depressing. He was just totally blunt and unsupportive. And when he tried to be funny, he was always sarcastic, you know. So I went out of there feeling like I'd been hit by a car. And later I talked to one of my colleagues, another junior person named Nancy Summers, who has since left Rutgers. She actually, I think after that meeting, she started looking for another place to work. But apparently he had called her into the office too for the meeting, the famous meeting with Tom. We were pretty close, Nancy and I, and we were having lunch, and she said she came out of that meeting, she went back to her office and just sobbed, you know. It was so devastating. And also, I have an administrative job, and it was when I came here to Rutgers, the man who had had the job before me was a man named George Kearns. And George had resigned from the job of running the writing program because he didn't get promoted to professor, full professor. And he had been on the committee that hired me, and he had hired me hoping I would come to Rutgers and fail. This is really true. Because he thought if I failed, they'd have to give him the full professorship. See, it would show nobody else could do this job. This is true. So anyway, I was under a lot of pressure to write and get things done, and I was in this very disorganized freshman program. It was unbelievably chaotic. George was not an administrator, even though he had run the program for 15 years, and it was extremely disorganized. And just to show you how much confidence George had in me, he went on leave for a year, and he left all his furniture, all his books, and all his personal effects in the office I was using. Isn't that interesting? So it was like saying, you won't even make it through a year, kid. You know? So this is very human. This happens to people all the time. And, you know, basically, I did two things to survive, you know. I jogged, and I did zazen. And I did zen, you know, I would get up and do my zazen, and then I'd go for a jog, and then I'd go to work. And sometimes I would get back at like 9 o'clock at night, and I'd, you know, I would sit down on the cushion, I'd have something to eat, and I would sit down on the cushion and sit. And that is how I survived at Rutgers, you know. And it was like magic, really, because there was a huge amount of pressure on me. I remember giving a talk to graduate students in the English department when I first, maybe a couple years into my job. And the graduate director came up to me after the talk and he said, man, I wouldn't want your job for $1 million. He was trying to be friendly. Just a lot of stress, you know, and a lot of pressure, and many problems. Like every day, there was some big problem. And so, you know, those problems include all kinds of things. When I just got here, there was a professor, actually an instructor, who had an affair with like he would have affairs with his undergraduate students. So I fired him, and he sued me, you know. And then also another person basically lied about what he was doing in class. And when I found out he wasn't teaching the course, he wasn't requiring his students to, I fired him. And his wife came with him to the last meeting where I fired him, and she actually spat in my face. Really, that really happened. So these are the kinds of things I had to do, you know. And by the way, she's still here at Rutgers. She is. Every time I see her, I sort of put my hand over my face. I'm preparing for another attack. But anyway, it was rough. And I would come home and sit. And, you know, I had been already training for many years in Seattle. And I had finished my training. There really wasn't a place for me at the Zen Center in Seattle. I had a PhD, and I got this job offer, so I came to Rutgers. It was, you know, much rougher than I had ever dreamed it would be. But my Zen really got me through, you know, and I would, you know, I would sit on the cushion and watch my breath. When I would watch my breath, I would start to get more calm for a little while, and I could feel some of the stress going away. You know, so you sit on the cushion, you watch your breath, and some of the stress begins to go away. And you begin to feel a little better. And beginners just get to this point. You know, so if you're just, sometimes people come to a Monday or Friday night sit, and they sit down on the cushion, and they just get to this point, and it's so beautiful, right? It's like you're under stress, and you start watching the breath, and you have this relaxation response. And it's just like all the tension can go out of your body, and you feel wonderful, right? And many beginners have that experience when they first come to meditation practice. And it's a great feeling. But actually, if you continue to do meditation, that state doesn't last, because you go deeper into your mind. So, when I would sit on the cushion, I would have the usual initial relaxation response. But then I would begin to notice the memories and the emotions and so on that were churning under the surface. You know, so sit down on the cushion, begin to feel better, and then there they would be. I would see Tom Van Land's face smoking in front of me, right? And he'd be going, "And you're out of here," right? He had a gravelly voice, you know. And then of course when I would rehearse those words in my head, I could feel the terror in my stomach, right? You know. Out of here. Or I could see Bill Dale Marcinko, the guy I fired, who took me to court. I could see the letter he circulated to all the faculty telling them I was a bad man. And so on, you know. And then I would feel fear, various emotions. This is a part of practice. You know, when you come and sit down on the cushion, many people just want to have like the relaxation response, and initially that's what beginners have. But you know, if Zen was just about coming in, sitting on the cushion and blissing out, this would be a drug. Because we have to work through our problems. We have to work through our obstacles. So just coming in and sort of chilling on the cushion, that's only get you so far, right? That would be not that helpful in the long run. So if you keep meditating after, say, a month or so, you're going to begin to enter a deeper level of the mind, and you're going to find you come face to face once again with the things that were may be frightening to you or agitating. And this is not a decline or a deterioration of your practice, it's a deeper stage of practice. And I was quite familiar with that. So I would sit on the cushion and I would enter deep relaxation, and then these things would come up and they'd trigger these emotional responses, and I would go back to my breath and back to Mushin. And, you know, after a while, Tom Van Land's face would sort of fade away. And the fear would fade away. And there would be moments where my mind was just resting serenely in the moment. And then some other memory would arise and new emotions would be triggered. But then if you just keep using the breath or you keep going back to Mushin, to empty mind, after a while, these responses stop happening and you observe what has happened. You observe the past event with a kind of neutral awareness, neutral mind. And then it just goes away and you find yourself just dwelling serenely in the moment. And this is a great achievement. It's really like the beginning of awakened mind, when you can work through your obstacles and they stop triggering these conditioned responses, and you just are dwelling serenely in the present, you know, without really thought, without emotion. And of course, when you enter that stage, many things happen. First of all, you have a very strong sense of like well-being or safety or connectedness. And you might notice something in your surroundings, and it will have a kind of freshness or texture that it might not ordinarily have if your mind was distracted. So many people have had this experience. After an evening of meditation, you'll have your tea and your cookie, or your tea and your date. And you might eat a cookie at home while you're watching the tube, right? Or you might eat a cookie while you're writing. And after it's over, you might not be sure you actually ate the cookie. You know, I do this too. Sometimes I'm so distracted I will do something and I'll wonder if I did it. Yes? I mean, I do that too. You know, I'll think, did I have lunch? You know? That happens to everybody. But when you have done an hour and a half of meditation and you drink that tea, your mind is just dwelling serenely in the present moment, almost in a thoughtless state. Thoughts are much fewer and farther between. And when you have that tea, it's so delicious, right? It's just so delicious. It's a pure presence. In Buddhism, we have a word for that. It's tat-tat-tat-tata. Tat-tata. Pure presentness. And it comes from having an empty mind, mushin. That state is really like nirvana, actually. That is enlightened mind. And the more time you spend there, the more wonderful it is, and more energizing and beautiful and transformative that state of awareness really can be. And that's what we're doing by doing so much zazen, you know, sitting on the cushion so often. In that state, it's very curious, you know. There doesn't seem to be a self anymore, like a fixed self. And that's quite interesting and important. You know, normal consciousness, ordinary consciousness, is all about the self. It's really all about the self. So all day long, you know, as we're going through ordinary life in ordinary consciousness, we're trying to maximize our pleasure and minimize our pain. this is like the ordinary consciousness of a human being. It's all about me, you know. You get up in the morning, you think, well, what would I like, you know, tea or coffee? Which would give me more pleasure? And then you look at the dishes and think, oh, I don't want to do those, that's too painful right now. So I'll do them later. So pleasure and pain, right? And this goes on all day long. You know, if you know you have to do something that will be difficult and painful, you think, oh, you know, maybe I'll put it off. You know, I'll do that report on Thursday. I won't do it today, you know. Or I'll get to that later, you know. Or you might think, maybe I can escape having to do it altogether. You know? I had a neighbor for many years in Highland Park. We had a neighbor upstairs. His name was Charlie Reich, and he's a chemical engineer who works for Colgate-Palmolive. And he was a wonderful guy, but he hated to write reports on his research. He hated to write up his research reports. And he said that he had gotten like 5 years behind in his research reports. And they would try to harass him, they'd try to threaten him and so on and intimidate him into doing, and he just couldn't do it. He said, I'd sit down, he said, I just can't stand it, you know. And I guess he was a pretty good chemical engineer, so they didn't fire him. And they made some deal where he would never have to turn him in or something like that. This is like pleasure and pain, right? You know. But the interesting thing is that when we enter this other state of consciousness, there doesn't seem to be a self. It really disappears, or it disappears for long periods of time, and then it you might become aware of yourself again, but there's long stretches where your awareness is just in the moment, without judgment. And this is quite a wonderful state. It's like consciousness is not anchored to a self anymore. And you're no longer fighting to protect yourself or to maximize your pleasure and minimize your pain. You know, all ordinary consciousness is very interesting because it's really fundamentally, like, I like this word, alienated. It's fundamentally like separate. All day long, if we're in ordinary consciousness, it's like we're looking at everything from a little bit of a distance. It's like we're watching a movie, or we're spectators, right? And everything is outside of ourselves, and everything is like a little bit away from us, yeah? And this can be a big problem. You know, you can feel very lonely and isolated when you're in this mind. And indeed, people go to great lengths to try to escape it, but usually they don't manage to escape it the right way. So, for example, when people drink alcohol, the sense of self is also diminished, right? But it's not a particularly good way to do it. But if you sit on the cushion, you notice that your sense of self goes away, and there's this wonderful sense of connectedness to things. The more you do it, the more wonderful it becomes. And it's very liberating not to be looking at everything from a distance. And it's very liberating not to be a spectator to reality, you know, but to be part of it all. Now, this is really wonderful. And it's quite different from ordinary consciousness. I'm sure you've had these experiences, and it's possible that they've been rather subtle, so you might not have appreciated what's going on. But the disappearance of the self is very important, and we have this profound sense of connection that follows from that. So this is something that most people who read books on Buddhism know about, you know, that at some level of consciousness, the self disappears. This sense of separation disappears. And then often, you know, people who are in what we say deep samadhi, in this state where the self has disappeared and you're dwelling serenely in the moment, if you hear rain, you might feel like you are the rain. Really, it's quite beautiful. Or if you hear a bird, it might feel like the bird call is coming right out of your own body. You know? That's a really beautiful experience. And I don't think it's a delusion at all. I think it's a deeper and clearer sense of things. You know, intellectually, we understand that everything is interrelated. This is like, people talk about this now all the time because of the environmental crisis, you know. We say everything is interrelated. And we know, scientifically, everything's interrelated. You can't have, you can't have oxygen for us to breathe without trees, right? And you can't have trees without, CO2 and without dirt and moisture. And you can't have those things without other things. And so basically, we know intellectually that everything is interconnected, but ordinary consciousness is very defective because it actually is quite disconnected, you know? I just got a copy of a magazine that I recently subscribed to called Buddha Dharma. And it's a wonderful magazine. I'm not getting any kickback for telling you that it's well worth getting. I thought it was a wonderful magazine. And they had an interview with a woman who was a brain scientist. I think her name is Christine Skarda, if I'm remembering correctly. S-K-A-R-D-A. Christine. She was a brain scientist, and she was studying many difficult questions in brain science. And she was like top drawer scientist, very, very respected, really a leading person in cognitive science. And she said, I was working on the problem of how, you know, we have, she said, she started with the assumption that our senses pick up little pieces of reality. So we hear a sound, right? Or we feel the wind blowing across our face. Or we see a bird flying past the window. She said, I was interested in how the mind puts together these isolated experiences and makes a kind of wholeness out of it. You know, that's what she said. And she said, I couldn't figure it out. She did all this research, she kept trying, and she said, one day it occurred to her that she was, her assumptions were getting in her way and that it was just the opposite of what she thought. She said, it isn't the case that our senses pick up pieces. She said, our awareness gives us the whole picture all the time. In other words, we don't just hear a piece, we don't just see a piece, we don't just feel, we experience wholeness. And she said, it's the discriminating mind that cuts it into little pieces, see. So it's not a case of how do we put it all together. The problem is we get like wholeness all the time, and we cut it into like manageable little pieces. At the same time she was making this discovery, when she made the discovery, by the way, she had no interest in Buddhism at all. But at the same time, somebody invited her to go hear a talk by a famous lama, famous Tibetan teacher, a Rinpoche, actually. And when she met the Rinpoche, he became very animated about meeting her. He didn't know anything about her at the time, but he got very excited and he said, oh, Ben, I know you. And she was like a scientific rationalist, and she got very mad at him. She said, that is bullshit. She didn't put it like that, but she said, you're conning me. She didn't put it like that either, but that's what she was thinking. And she got in her car and she left in a fury. But she couldn't put it down, you know, it just bothered her. And then her friend said, let's go back and see that lama again. So she went back to the lama, and he annoyed her again to an extraordinary degree, you know. But she got interested and later she met the Dalai Lama, and she went to Dharamsala, and she studied, she began to train. She began to do formal training for years and years. And she lives. She's been she went for long secluded, like a 3-year sesshin, basically, in Dharamsala. And she did this on and on. And now she's back here. And she lives in Colorado. And she has like a little hut with no heating. She lives up in the mountains. And she made a joke. She said that she doesn't need a refrigerator. She said, in the winter, if you leave the food on the table, it just freezes right there. So anyway, I thought that was so revealing. You know, we experience wholeness, and then we cut it to pieces. And I think that the self is what emerges when we cut it to pieces. The self arises in this process of cutting things to pieces. And when we start experiencing wholeness again, what we call the self disappears, right? And we become part of something, we feel connected with something larger, you know, something bigger. Now, you know, it's interesting. In Zen, we use terms all the time that seem to go against what I'm saying. So for example, in Zen we talk about true self. We say true self, true nature. Original self, we say. See, original self. Now sometimes I'll say to people, I'll say, you know, be true to your true self. Be true to your true nature. Now, that seems to contradict this, you know, this experience of no self is so important, it's so liberating. So what are we talking about in Zen when we talk about true self, big self? Well, my second teacher, Webb, always used to talk about the big self. There's the little self and the big self. Be true to your big self. So what self is that? This is very important. Many people misunderstand this and get confused. I was also reading in Buddha Dharma magazine an interview with a famous Theravada teacher. His name is Mahasi Sayadaw. He's dead now, but he influenced an enormous number of people. He was a great Theravada meditation master, and he has a talk in Buddha Dharma magazine, and if you read it, it's like classic Theravada Buddhism. It's excellent. You know, he talks about how there is no self. And he takes you through very analytically experience. You know, if you're, you know, you can feel pain in your leg, but you know it's not yourself. And you can hear sound, but you know it's not yourself. And if you go through this process, you realize the self is nowhere. You know, the self is like an imaginary friend. My cousin, actually, the number of people I've known who had imaginary friends. My cousin, my mother's brother's kid, had an imaginary friend. And, you know, would have a little place at dinner for it, you know, and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Would walk around talking. Well, self, you know, basically, Mahasi Sayadaw says, you know, if you just look, there's no real self there. There's no self. And when you read it, it's very persuasive, but actually, you know, I don't think that's quite true. See, I don't think that's quite true. And I think this is kind of one of the differences between, like, Theravada and Zen belongs to what's called the Mahayana. It's a different tradition. They're both Buddhism. And enlightenment is the same, but little different approach. When the Buddha was asked about the existence of a self, he said, there's no self. He said, it's not the case that there's a self, and it's not the case that there's not a self. So that's what he actually said. He didn't say no self. He said, it's not the case that there is a self, and it's not the case that there's not a self. Now that's very interesting. See, it's not exactly no self. This is very difficult to get our minds around because the human mind says something either is or is not the case. But when you look at reality, it's a little different from that. So think, you know, something like this. An acorn is not an oak tree, right? Or is that true? See, the acorn actually is an oak tree, and it's not an oak tree, right? You know, it's very difficult to say at what point the acorn stopped being an acorn and it became an oak tree. In fact, some of the cells in the acorn are still alive in the oak tree. So the mind wants to say yes or no, but it's really the case that that things are more complicated than yes, no. So the self is real, actually. It is. But it's not permanent. It's not permanent, but it is real in a conditional way. And in fact, everything is real in a conditional way. You know, so no matter how deeply you go into mushin, sooner or later you're going to have a moment where self-awareness returns. See, and so. If you say there's no self, you're kind of denying something that's really part of your life. You know, the self isn't permanent, and the self is constantly changing, and in the deeper levels of consciousness it disappears. But it's part of the whole picture. You could say the self is an emergent property of certain moments. That's the truth. It's not always present. It's present under certain conditions, but it's present. So it's not quite true to say there is no self. There is a self, but it's always changing. It's not permanent, and in my opinion, it's not eternal. You know, it was very interesting to my mother's last years. My mother had Alzheimer's disease, and it was very interesting. It was painful, but inevitable. We're all going to die. We're all going to get old. You know, I saw my mother's memories go one by one into oblivion, right? And after a while, my mother couldn't remember her own sister. My mother, when she was a little girl, used to speak French. She couldn't remember any French words. And she couldn't remember her own. She couldn't remember if her sister were alive or dead. She couldn't remember if her son had died. You know. So I actually at one point brought a scrapbook, and I tried to go through the book with her so I could sort of like see if there was anything she could relive or she couldn't. These images, her mother, her father, her sister. She couldn't even remember them. Now, was she my mother or not? See, I mean, everything we have that makes us up is going to go away. But on the same time, you know, the self is real now, right? It's here. It's not everything we are. It's not everything we are. But there is a self in a conditional way. And so it's important to live in yourself the right way. See, if you just say there's no self, you're kind of missing something about life. We have to be a self sometimes, and so you have to be intelligent about it and creative about it. So you could be a self in a selfish and destructive way, or you could be yourself in a loose, expansive, and creative sort of way. See, this is what true nature is all about. See, you do have a self. It's not permanent, it's not eternal, but it's you're there sometimes. And so when Mahasi Sayadaw says there's no self, he's not quite getting at the truth. Because you are going to be a self sometime. And you'll have problems, and you can't just go, oh well, I'm not going to worry about that, there's no self. See, actually that's not such a good thing. You know, sometimes people hurt my feelings. You know, sometimes people say things to me that hurt. And so every once in a while I'll catch myself saying, oh, that doesn't bother me because I do a lot of zazen. But see, I'm repressing, aren't I? Right? That's repression. I'm denying something. And I sit down on the cushion, and I go, oh, that didn't bother me. And then I sit on the cushion, all of a sudden I have my nice relaxation response, and then, oh, ouch, that really hurt. That hurt my feelings. Now I could feel ashamed of this and try to cover it up and say, well, you know, of course, Zen teachers don't have any feelings. But that's a lie. That's not true. There was a famous Zen master who cried at his teacher's funeral. Somebody came up and said, I thought you had Daikensho. What are you doing crying at your teacher's funeral? The guy said, shut up. I'll cry if I want to cry. You know? So that's part of life, you know. That's part of life. So the thing is, we have a conditional self, and it's important to inhabit it properly. Now, we can't be intelligent if we deny that we are there sometimes. You know, sometimes we're in ourselves. So the question is, how are you going to be a self? And that's very, very crucial. That's really crucial. So you could live with your eyes turned towards the smallest part of yourself, right? You know, you could be greedy, you could be aggressive, you can be constantly protecting yourself from pain and maximizing your pleasure. And that's what we call the small self. That's like a small-minded self. It's all about me, right? Okay. But then, you know, there's another way to live, which is to live with your eyes always turned to Mu Xin. So you're sort of living with your eyes turned to Mu Xin. And this is a completely different way to live, right? Because, you know, when you have a problem, you, instead of sort of closing up into your little self, and you know, we all do that sometimes, you know, we get mad, he's a bastard, you know, or we think, oh, I'm no good, you know, or I'm an unlovable person, you know, I'm a horrible person, blah, 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 you know, I'm stupid, I'm ugly, whatever, you know. We get angry all the time. This is quite common, you know. Academics are very angry a lot of the time for some reason, and they get, you know, they're constantly angry at something, you know. And so they're living like small self. The eyes are always turned to the small self. But you can live with your eyes turned to Mu Xin, and that's what we call big mind. That's what we call true nature or true self. See, you live in. You live facing Mu Xin, and this is what's going on in this koan. See, Zuigang has already had Daikensho. He's been practicing for many, many years, but you know, things bother him, you know. So he gets up in the morning and he does his zazen, and he sits on the cushion and he goes, Zuigang Gen Osho called to himself every day. He sits down in the cushion and he goes, Master, so I'm calling. Enlightened mind, I'm calling Mu Xin. He goes, Master. And then he answers himself. If you saw this, this would be like, we might think this is like a psychotic episode, right? Because he said, if you saw it, if you would peek through the screen and see him, he'd start doing his zazen, and then he'd go, Master. Then he'd go, yes. Say, how are you today? Good. See? It's like split. This is schizophrenia, maybe, right? But actually, it's how things really are. You know, we are sometimes in our small self, and we're sometimes in a bigger mind. And you're lying if you say, oh, I'm never in myself anymore. That's a lie. You know, if anybody ever says, I'm totally enlightened and I've worked through all my karma, I swear to you, that person is not telling you the truth, and you should leave that person as soon as you can. Okay? And if somebody says to you, I'm never in the small self, that person is deeply screwed up, actually, right? That person is not telling you that he is not facing something on the cushion, or that person is a phony, you know, has just done no practice and is a charlatan. But the Dalai Lama is the most unpretentious person in the world, you know, and he is quite aware that sometimes he's just an old man who has hemorrhoids, you know, and so on and so on. And so, but the difference between, say, the Dalai Lama and somebody who's not is the Dalai Lama is deep, his eyes are deeply turned towards shunyata and enlightened mind, right? So you know, Zuigan is really like actually a very healthy person, even though he seems like a schizophrenic person, because he's going back and forth between like little mind, big mind, little mind, big mind. Little self, big self, right? And he's turning to big mind. He's turning to Mushin to help him with his little self problems, right? So Zuigan Gen Osho called himself every day. You know, he's master, and the master says, "Yes, what is it, Zuigan?" You know, and he says, "He hurt my feelings," you know. He says, "Oh, I understand, you know, but let's sit on the cushion for a while, and after a while, all of this will drop away, and you'll feel connected to everything." So Zuigan does that, right? And then he goes, "Okay, so he hurt my feelings, big deal. You know, tomorrow when I see him, I'm going to give him a big kiss, right on the forehead, see?" And that's acting from big mind, see? So he's not going to go, "Oh, you hurt my feelings, I'm not talking to you," right? That's a small mind response. Big mind is to say, "Well, I've hurt people's feelings too. I know this guy was afraid, and actually, my heart is full of love to this person." You know? So that's a healthy way to. We have a self. It's not immortal. It doesn't even last through a lifetime. Everything we have that makes up a self will be gone soon. You know? But it's like a wave on the ocean. The wave is part of the ocean, but it's really a wave, you know. While the wave is a wave, you know, a wave comes out of the ocean and it rises up and then it goes back into the ocean. This is like the self. But the wave is really a wave while it's moving, right? So it's not really true to say there's no waves, you know. The ocean is full of waves. And the wave is nothing but ocean, but it's also distinctively a wave, you know. So you have a self. It's not eternal. It's not immortal. But it's here sometimes. You're in it sometimes. And so the question is, how are you going to live? So this is, if you've ever taken a philosophy course, there's a word that's called existential. It's a terrifying word, right? And so much baloney has been written. You know? But there is this dimension of like existential dimension of life. How are you going to live, you know? And that you can live stupidly or skillfully. You can live closed up or you can live opened up. You can be, you know, fearful and angry. You can be loving and generous, you know? So there is a kind of self. See, that Zen is saying to Mahasi Sayadaw, you know, you're not quite right. Because yes, ultimately, in the highest level of consciousness, there is no self. But we're not always in that level. So how are we going to live in this level right now? And life is really great. You know, it's like you get the best of both worlds. It's really great. You get to be a little self, and you get to be the big self, you know? And your enlightened mind can help you out of all kinds of scrapes and difficulties that your little self gets itself into, you know? And that's a wonderful way to exist, in my opinion. Zuigan Gen Osho called to himself every day, "Master," and answered, "Yes, sir." Then he'd say, "Be wide awake." He'd say, "Okay." And then he'd say, "You're not going to let, you know," the little mind would say, "Listen, you're not going to let this stuff get you down, are you?" And the big mind would say, "Not a chance. There's no obstacles. No obstacles." So the little mind's afraid, right? It's worried. The big mind says, "Don't worry. Don't worry. Everything is under control." It's a beautiful way to live. Momo's comment. Old Zuigon buys and sells himself. It's all big mind. It's the big mind as big mind and big mind as little mind. Right? He takes out a lot of god masks and devil masks and puts them on and plays with them. What for, eh? One calling and the other answering. One wide awake, the other saying he will never be deceived. If you stick to any of them, you will be a failure. If you imitate Zuigon, you play the fox. Well, this is all a compliment, right? Remember, in the Mumonkan, when the Mumon says somebody's an idiot or something like that, he means he's a great Zen practitioner. Mumon's verse. Clinging to the small mind, students of the Dharma do not realize the truth. The seed of birth and death through endless eons. The fool calls it the true original self. So, you know, being trapped in the little self is an unpleasant experience. And when we sit on the cushion and we enter big mind, it's really and truly liberation. Then we can go back to little self and really have a wonderful day, you know? So, thank you for coming to practice today. Please practice, you know, wholeheartedly with diligence and enjoy this beautiful life.